Good morning, and I'll call our first interim meeting of the Senate Interim Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development to order. And we have primarily an informational agenda today, but we wanted to start off by introducing committee members. And two of our members are not with us today. Senator Prezantsky is at work in his day job over in Florence. And then Senator George also had a business commitment, so he won't be here with us this morning. So I want to welcome back our capable vice chair, Senator Telfer. And hope you had a good summer. And
I did. It's a little too short.
Yes.
Just missed a month.
Yeah. I was over in Bend this weekend in your district, in fact, and looks like you were getting the last of the summer weather, and we were taking advantage of it.
Oh, good for you. Drop those dollars in our area.
That's great. We didn't spend a huge amount of money, but my husband did buy a car in your district.
He did. He even told me that. Yeah, I ran into him over there, and
right.
He told me he just bought a car. So, small world.
Great. So, welcome back, Senator Telfer. And then we have a new member to the committee, Senator Manas Anderson. Had a conflict in being called on to serve on the newly created Veterans Affairs Committee. So we have the capable Senator Rod Monroe joining us. And
they just plug me in anywhere. Actually, I served on Commerce in 07, and so I have some familiarity with some of the issues that we're dealing with. And look forward to working with you, Madam Chair.
Great. Well, we're glad to have you. And then we have, obviously, staff that we did not have before. And so our committee administrator, Teresa Van Winkle. Teresa and I have worked together a lot in the past. When I was over on the House side, she was the very excellent staff of the House Business and Labor Committee, which I believe she will continue to staff, and then is picking up our committee as well. And those are your two.
Yes, Madam Chair. And then the House Business Committee also has a subcommittee on workforce development, and I'm the administrator for that as well.
Great. And our committee assistant is Cindy Hupp, and Cindy is the one who will keep us on track and on the record and off the record and all those good things. So, Cindy, we're really glad to have you, too. So our first order of business for today will be adoption of our committee rules, and they should be out in front of you, a copy of the Senate Interim Committee rules. I think these are the sort of boilerplate rules that all committees will be operating under. Teresa, is there anything to point out about these, or are they?
Not that I know, Madam Chair. They are the standard rules, as you said, boilerplate rules for every Senate policy committee, and no, there are really no significant changes.
Great. So if you want to take a moment, and then a motion would certainly be in order.
Madam Chair, I'd move adoption of the proposed committee rules as presented here.
Senator Telfer moves adoption of our interim committee proposed rules for Commerce and Workforce Development. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, committee rules are adopted. And on our agenda, we are going to start with a presentation from the Employment Department on unemployment insurance benefits. This has continued, obviously, to be a key topic for our state as our unemployment has not actually declined and, in fact, has continued apace. So we're going to start with a presentation from Director Lori Warner and Tom Byerly, Director of the Assistant Director of the Employment Department, on what's going on with the UI program. And we saw a lot of you two during the regular session in 2009, and we passed some significant legislation, so we're looking forward to hearing how that's working out. So welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, for the record, my name's Lori Warner. I'm the Director of the Employment Department, and with me is Tom Byerly, the Division Administrator for Unemployment Insurance. So you should have a packet of material in front of you, some slides we're going to go through here with you, and then, of course, we're happy to answer any questions you might have. So this is an update for you from where we left off in May when we were talking about the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund and the unemployment rate and claims and sort of the legislation that passed. So we'll try to wrap all those things together and give you an update. So the very first slide shows you that Oregon is sitting at right now in August, fourth in the nation in terms of unemployment rate. We have been in the top 3 to 5 for about the past 6 months for across the nation, and I was just at a National Association of State Workforce Agency Directors. These folks were in attendance, as well as many other states that were there that had what you would consider lower unemployment rates in the 8 to 9% range. But to a state, they were all concerned that they had pockets in their state that could be, even though their overall unemployment rate might be 8 or 9, they had pockets, areas that were 12, some of them 15%, and they were all supporting the additional extended benefits at the federal level and hoping that that would come about to give some relief to their states in terms of the unemployed. So we have continued, and we did not see this summer, if you followed this, the May unemployment rate was around 12.2. We had about 11.9 in July, and we're now sitting at 12.2. So we didn't see a significant decline in the unemployment rate. And Tom's going to go through some slides here with you about the claims that we do have and the projections through this fall. And then at the end, we'll wrap up and look at what the trust fund is, where the trust fund is right now, and where what we're doing with the with that. So I'll let Tom go through the rest of these slides, and then we'll wrap up.
Great. Thank you, Lori.
Thank you, Lori. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Byerly. I'm the Administrator for Unemployment Insurance for the Employment Department. Some of these slides are some of the same slides we showed you when we were here during session, but the next slide in line there is our initial claims or new claims, and this is from a September 2009 forecast. The solid
Tom,
line.
Tom, let me just stop you for a minute. Who's operating the PowerPoint?
Actually, we're just going to work off.
Off the handout. Paper. Oh, okay. So we don't actually need that. And were there copies so the audience could?
Yes, there's several copies in the back.
Okay.
Thank you. Again, the solid line are actual claims that we've taken, and you can the little blocks line up with the quarters there beginning in January of 2007, and as we've chronicled the steady increase with a slight falling off of new claims. But we're forecasting this coming winter, January through March, to have another pretty significant spike in workload, as you see with new claim filings. So thanks to some of the work of our Ways and Means Subcommittee, we do have some limited duration positions that we're training right now to be ready for that workload. So we are actually thinking we're going to be in better shape to handle the work than we were last year. We learn things every year as we go. Turning to the next slide is the week's claim. Those are the weekly claims that individuals
Chair.
Make.
Yes, Senator
is there
Monroe.
Some particular reason for that proposed projected spike, that big spike? I mean, that seems like an aberration.
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, we're forecasting the continued decline in job losses, and Art Arrow will be coming along behind us to share a little bit more information about that. But there are several different industries that are seasonal-based, and it's a normal spike that time of year. It's just going to be exacerbated with the continued unemployment and job loss.
Okay.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
On the next slide is the weekly claims, and you can see that those have been steady and are on the slight increase as well. These cover the claims for all programs, regular benefits as well as the extensions, and you can see that we're significantly higher than we were in 2007. Thankfully, our projections are to come down towards the end of 2010.
I would say, Senator Monroe, to your question, if you look back in 07, if you see the pattern on the weeks claimed, it would be the same on the initial claims, too. But you see, there's normally that line normally dips in July through September and then starts climbing back up October, December, January, February, March. So it's just when that's the 07 kind of inverted dip there. But if you look at what we're experiencing in 08, that isn't there. When we look at this summer, we see that being flat across there as opposed to taking it. Usually it takes a slight downturn. So, and it's at a much higher rate anyway level than where we were before. So, you know, it's continuing. We're continuing to see job losses. We're continuing to get more notices from employers and layoffs. So we're not quite finished yet. And then there's the seasonal downturn that you would normally expect because this summer seasonal businesses did hire. They just probably didn't hire in the same percentages that they had in the past years, and we're not seeing that dip in the unemployment rate.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
But isn't there usually an increase, a temporary increase in employment just before Christmas?
There can be, but there's also a lot of that's masked by the downturn in the seasonality. So I think when Art's up, he can speak to what those percentages perhaps are for you. But true, there is some. I think it's usually in the retail area, and I think if you've been following the news articles and such, retailers are still not very optimistic about what consumers are going to do in terms of purchasing. So we're still suffering in that arena.
The next slide is an overview of the UI benefit programs, and I do this in preparation of the following slide, but I wanted to mention and remind you that in Oregon we have 26 weeks of regular benefits that everybody gets when they first file their claim. Then we have the completely federally funded emergency unemployment compensation, or EUC as we call it. Right now, claimants in Oregon are eligible for 33 weeks because of the level of unemployment we have. Then we have extended benefits or emergency benefits, which is 20 weeks. And normally that's a state and federal shared extension where we pay half and the feds pay half. Out of the American or the ARRA, Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the feds are paying 100% on this extension, which is a huge savings to our trust fund. It's very significant that that's going on. Then another extension is Oregon Emergency Benefits, and that's the extension that was passed out of House Bill 3483, came before this committee towards the end of session. And that's a 13-week extension that will be funded solely from the Oregon Trust Fund. It is set to begin October 4th, next Sunday, providing we don't get any relief from the feds, and I'll talk about that in a moment. You'll see another acronym, AB, Oregon Additional Benefits. This is an extension that's been on the books for many, many years, and it only triggers on if there are no other extensions available, if the federal extensions, for whatever reason, we've triggered off and we still have a level of unemployment that warrants it. So it's only there for reference. So I'd like to turn to the next slide that has the bar graph of the weeks claimed by the
Madam Chair.
Program.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
Just to summarize, people could be eligible for up to a year and a half of unemployment benefits, it looks like.
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, right now we're paying 79 weeks, which is close to a year and a half, yes. The next slide is a bar graph that shows our weekly claims by quarter, by benefit program, and that's reflected in the different colors. It's interesting to note that at the beginning of 2009 through where we are today, the actual regular benefits, the number of weeks claimed in regular benefits, is higher, you'll note, than all the programs we paid out in the last recession. This is a real stark picture of how deep this recession is compared to the 2002-2003. Mm-hmm. And then the other extensions are there in the color. Again, it's been a huge boon to Oregon to have these federal extensions that are available for Oregonians that are out of work that are fully federally funded, and you can see how far that puts us up the scale. You can see the little cream-colored one in the, let's see, that's January, March of 2010. Actually, it's the quarter before. It'd be October through December. That's the emergency extension that's scheduled to trigger on next Sunday for those that have exhausted all other federal extensions. Now, I will say the Congress is considering an additional 13 weeks of emergency unemployment compensation in addition to the 33. It has passed the House. It's now on the Senate side for consideration. We don't have any information relating to when they will take it up. We've been working closely with Senator Wyden's office and providing information about exhaustions and the amount of Oregonians that are out of work. They will take it up in the, I believe it's Senate Finance there, and hopefully there'll be something coming soon, because if they've passed that additional 13 weeks, we will not need to go on to the state extension that we passed, and that money will remain in the trust fund. Now, I want to make sure you're aware, while we're scheduled to go on to that on Sunday, we will be converting people and setting them up on that extension that have exhausted all of their benefits. But if the federal extension kicks in, we'll then move them back off of that extension to keep that money in the trust fund. And then as they exhaust the federal extension, if the Oregon Emergency Benefit Program is still around, which is scheduled to sunset January 2nd, so the chances are it won't be, we would put them back onto that program. So we're going to be working extra hard with customers, juggling them back and forth on these extensions. And you can imagine that our inquiry lines at our UI centers are just jam-packed with anxious workers that are wondering, what's happening next? What's coming next? I'm hearing Congress is doing this. What are you guys doing? We have sent 12,000 letters out to potential eligible Oregonians, letting them know to contact us on October 5th so they can figure out and help them determine if they're eligible for which extension. So suffice to say, next week is going to be quite busy for us in our UI centers as we get people onto our different extensions to make sure that they have coverage. Because, again, their anxiety is, where's my next bit of income coming from to pay my bills?
And I know you're going to talk about the rate of people who have run out of their benefits, but when these extensions kick in, do they go back retroactively to when people ran out of benefits, or do they just start from whatever point the extension is authorized?
Madam Chair, that's a good question, but they do start when the extension was authorized by law. So if someone exhausted their benefits in August, they have had to go without benefits until we trigger onto the Oregon Emergency Extension next week. So we will put them on the extension next week. They claim that week the following Sunday, and they'll get a payment on Wednesday. So we're still, you know, a week and a half away from getting people, actually 2 weeks from tomorrow, from getting them any benefits that they've been waiting for.
And there, you know, there were, we talked with the committee, there were about 4,000 to 5,000 folks that have exhausted in August and September, Oregonians that have had no benefits during this time period. So we have had inquiries. You have possibly had inquiries from your constituents. Rebecca Nance, who does our legislative work, has been working closely with members where they have constituents in that situation, because folks are very anxious. The letters I get in my office are along those lines, too, not sure what to do next. So the Oregon extension is really going to be helpful to those folks, and we certainly hope that the federal extension comes along. So people aren't, you know, able to find work yet, and they have been looking, and we have been working with them, too, but we don't have the jobs yet in all areas to try to get those folks reemployed. So critical issue right now.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Monroe.
I would imagine some of those people then were not able to pay their rent, and so FEDs are going out, and they're facing possible eviction, or if they have a mortgage, they weren't able to pay their mortgage, they may be facing the possibility of bankruptcy. Pretty critical. I guess it shows how important it was for us to vote on that extension. Too bad it didn't take effect a little sooner.
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, that's the nature of the letters that I get. And, of course, we try to refer these folks to the Social Service Safety Net, which is, you know, provides some relief for them. But, you know, we aren't able to cover, as you're suggesting, if they have trouble with mortgage payment, rent payment, basic food and things like that. They can sometimes get through food banks and other social service safety nets. But, yeah, that's where it's at.
Well, I know the demand. I'm on the board of Fish Emergency Services, which distributes primarily food to about 20,000 people. And I know the demand on our services has spiked dramatically this summer.
Turning to the next slide, what a great segue, or not. UI exhaustions by benefit program. The red line is the state-federal shared extended benefits. The green line is the emergency unemployment compensation. And the blue line that jags all over is regular benefits. And you can see how the exhaustions are running on extended benefits, which is the critical line, the red one. We had a spike in the middle of August. And with that spike, those people are completely out of benefits. Those are the ones that we're going to serve starting next week on the Oregon Emergency Benefit Program. Then those come down, and they're going to run about 500 to 600 per week for the next several weeks. All those people will be eligible if Congress doesn't pass the emergency initial 13 weeks. They'll be eligible for the Oregon Emergency Benefits. But you can see how the exhaustions were really high in regular benefits this summer. Mm-hmm. We moved them to the green line, and then they've exhausted. Then those go to the red line as we move through the continuum. And they sort of flatten out, which is a good thing, but with continued job losses expected, we want to make sure people have benefits that need them.
So why was there such a dramatic number in between August and September? It seems like people would be sort of staggered all along a continuum of these 79 weeks.
I was at the conference with Lori last week, and one of the things we learned from our colleagues that we all experienced about the same thing. Unemployment normally starts to rise in the fall, maybe close to Thanksgiving on a normal cycle. In 2008, we just got slammed in the summer, July and August. The claims really exploded. So a year later, those people are running out of benefits. And that's where you start seeing that. So in June and July, those people are running out of benefits. And some folks that had filed their claims earlier in the year of 2008 were exhausting all benefits right about the same time. Mm. It's amazing how we kind of had this rush all at once because of layoffs. And there's all kinds of reasons and speculation why they all came at once. But we really experienced a large number of claim filings all at the same time. And therefore, there was a spike of exhaustions all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And the same nationally, it sounds like.
We heard pretty similar trends across the United States. And as Lori indicated, many states that are only 9% have pockets. I heard as high as 18%. I know in central and eastern Oregon we've got pockets like that. So there are some pretty hard-hit areas.
Thanks.
Turn to the next slide entitled Benefits Paid. This is a slide that we've also shown to Senate Commerce as well as our Ways and Means Subcommittee. And there's that green line from 2009 that's just way above the rest of the years. I wanted to share a comparison to show some trends for the last 4 years. Just comparing the month of August, from 2006, for the entire month, we paid $34 million in benefits. In 2007, we were pretty much on track with that. We paid $37 million in benefits. In 2008, August again, we jumped to $71 million in benefits paid out. August 2009, buckle your seatbelt, $236 million in 1 month. We're paying more on a Monday, $44 million on average, just on a Monday, than we did in an entire month 3 years ago. Just another reflection of how hard we've been hit with this recession. Turning to the next page, 2009 legislation. Senate Bill 462 was really a cornerstone of legislation we had that helped us obtain some additional monies for our trust fund through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, also referred to as UI Modernization. Senate Bill 462 gave us an alternate base year. And what that allowed us to do, if someone didn't qualify for benefits under the normal base period, which is the first four of the last five completed calendar quarters, we could go to the last four completed calendar quarters. We began in July 1, 2009, so I've got 2 months worth of statistics since September is not done yet. The average monthly claims we validated are 342, so that's 342 people per month that wouldn't have been otherwise eligible before. Their average weekly benefit amount is $135. That's on the low scale because these people are either new to the workforce or coming back in the workforce, as we testified earlier in the last session. And it's taking us, on average, about 13 and a half calendar days to validate those claims because we're having to go to employers and get those wage records from them. And you can see of our workload, it's about 1% of our overall new claims workload.
So I wanted to just get you to talk a little more about the implementation of this program, and I hate anecdotal questions, but I did run into somebody who had experienced the ABY and said that they had to ask to have their claim reevaluated and were initially told that they still weren't eligible under ABY, and then a second look was made at it, and they did actually qualify. So talk a little bit about this data that you need to request from employers, and I would think that as this becomes part of our system, is that going to automatically be data that employers are reporting?
It is data that they automatically report anyway, and how it works is employers report their wages to us each quarter for the prior quarter. It is due 30 days following the close of the quarter. So let's just use the month of July, for instance. Employers were required to report their working earnings of their employees for April, May, and June by July 31. So for the month of July, probably the first 3 weeks of July, we may not have that information in from the employers yet. So if we look at somebody's claim and it's non-valid and they say, well, I've worked right up to, say, mid-June or late May, we would go to the employer and ask them with a letter to give us that information so we can add it to their claim. That actually comes to a couple of specialists in Salem. As we progress in the reporting period, though, towards the end of July and then in August, that information is already there, and we can actually do it in a couple days by going through our wage files that we already have on record. Now, unfortunately, if someone had to ask for that, that's not what we've instructed staff. Whenever there's a claim that's non-valid, we have trained them to look to see if there's wages that we can go after. So early on, we may have had some hiccups with that. As we've hired new staff and trained them, we're having people actually look for that as just an automatic course of business. When a claim is non-valid, the next thing we think of is, okay, can we do an alternate base year?
So people don't have to separately apply or request that calculation. It's now happening.
No, it's
routinely
automatic. Yeah, we're trying to validate as many claims as we can. We want to get people the money.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually been we had a few bumps in the road at first, but I think it's working pretty well. And I've talked to staff, and they think it's working pretty well as well.
And is there a separate unit of intake people that are doing that, or is it just part of the regular?
Madam Chair, it's part of the regular intake unit in the UI Center. But if we actually need to contact an employer, we send it to our specialists in Salem that will actually contact the employer. And if we can't contact them, we'll actually send someone to the employer's location and see if we can take a look at their books or just encourage them to reply so we can get the wages in the system. I haven't heard of no employers that are saying, oh, wait a minute, what are we doing here? They've all been very cooperative.
Right. Because it's the same data they have to report.
Yes.
Anyway.
Yes.
Eventually.
Just sometimes it's just more than they're normally required to report it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks. Okay.
The next slide is a trust fund worksheet.
So this is what you saw in May at the end of session, and there's a lot of numbers on here, and we are, as you'll recall, we calculate at the end of September, we look at the trust fund balances and set the tax schedule rate for employers for the following year, beginning in January. So we communicate out about, we're done with these calculations usually about mid-October, and we send notices to employers about the first part of November saying this is the tax schedule you're going to be in for the following year. So if on this chart for 2009, in the third column over, the tax schedule for 2009 was Schedule 3. So we sent that notice out to employers last November saying you'll be in tax schedule 3 for all of 2009, which is where they have been. And when we talked with you during the session, we kept looking at what would the projection look like for 2010. We originally were suggesting that we thought it would be a tax schedule 5, and then that was about March. And by May, it moved to tax schedule 6 with, if you look at the far right, a margin of $143 million before you would go to tax schedule 7. So what staff are doing now, they're looking at the claim activity and the amount paid out June, July, and August, as well as September payments, to determine what the final tax schedule is going to be and what this ending balance, this margin, will be. What I can tell you today is we still project that we'll be in tax schedule 6 for 2010. But this margin, this $143 million margin, will most likely be about $100 million less than what we saw in May. So you're going to get down to, you know, $43 million in that range. Two factors going on. This $143 million did not include the payout of $30 million for the Oregon benefit program. At the time we did this for you, it had not passed yet. And we've had additional claim activity over the summer, more than what we would have projected, and so we have higher payments out of the trust fund. What that will do is it will roll forward into, if you look at the left-hand column, the projected ending balance for the trust fund on August 31st. You see, we started out in 2008 at $2 billion, in 2009, $1.5 billion. And then in 2010, you're projected at about $789 million, and then 2011, $529. So you're seeing the trust fund shrink in terms of ending balance available for cash flow purposes as you go through the recession. And this is going to get on the ending balance side, August 31st, it's going to drop that down further in terms of what that is. And when this gets to zero, that's when states start borrowing from the federal government to pay for benefits, when your trust fund is out of money, essentially, is what happens. We don't project that happening right now, but again, it depends on how long the recession lasts and how deep over the next year this goes in terms of when we finally get, you know, people coming back with jobs and back on the payrolls. So we need to watch this closely and be talking with you as we go through this. Tom and I talked about perhaps coming back to your meeting in November, because we will have final numbers then on the September, both the tax schedule and the balances in the trust fund. So we can have that conversation. We will also know by then whether the federal government has funded 13 more weeks of benefits, and they're going to be picking up, you know, the cost, as opposed to our trust fund picking up that cost this fall. So I will say there was a lot of discussion about trust fund solvency among the states at the meeting we were recently at. States are borrowing about $16 billion right now from the federal government. There are 22 states that are currently borrowing. They project that we'll go to 35 states that will be borrowing in 2010, 38 states by 2011, and 40 states by 2012. For a total, they expect by 2012 of $90 billion being borrowed from states to pay unemployment insurance benefits. So a number of states are, you know, looking at this and also going to be talking with their governors and legislators about how to set up their trust funds so that they remain solvent in recessions. Many states have taxable wage bases still that are in the $7,000 to $10,000 range. Oregon's is $31,000, and so they have a big difference in the taxable wage base that's covering the UI trust fund, which is one of their bigger problems, and they're not indexed for inflation and such, growth in wages. So it really comes home to hit them hard, in the recession when this happened. So I think this is going to be not only a state discussion, but a federal discussion. The ARRA legislation helps states in that it's not requiring them to pay interest on this money they're borrowing. But again, you know, how long can that go on, and what does that mean in the long run in terms of the federal-state partnership? So I would just say we still feel fortunate in Oregon that we have a solvent trust fund, and we've been careful about what we did with the trust fund. So that's pretty much wraps up the information. The marble chart at the very last slide you have is the chart that shows the various tax rates over history. That and we talked about this before, where we've been in tax schedule 3, and you can see we've been there for quite a number of years in terms of the lower levels. But oftentimes after a recession, you shift up. You have to tax schedule 8 in order to rebuild the balance in your trust fund, and that's usually a lag. So we're going to go to 6, and then we'll go to 8 as we come out of the recession, and we'll watch closely how we're doing in terms of the ending balance in the trust fund. So with that, Madam Chair, if folks have other questions, we'd be happy to answer.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that Lori said we were fortunate. I'd say we're smart, that we've planned this well, that we have a solvent trust fund. I'm shocked that some states have a base of 7 or 10,000. I think ours at 31 is too low, which is one of the things that we could do to keep the rate lower would be to raise the threshold so that it is applied to some middle-income wages, not just the base lower wages. Something that I think we could look at if we face the possibility of insolvency, rather than just keep raising the rates, I would suggest that we look at that threshold as well. Another way of keeping our trust fund solvent, but you know, it's really shocking to me that up to 40 states are going to have to borrow from the federal government. In a way, does that mean that because we're solvent, we're in a way being punished? In other words, that you know, our taxes that go to the federal government, essentially, will be subsidizing those states that have not planned well and have not created a solvent fund?
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, I did raise that question with the association when I was there. As you know, the states, those of us, the other, you know, 12 states will be down to a handful. You know, if 40 are borrowing and 12 of us aren't, you know, what are those equities or inequities going to be between the states? And what the federal government is covering. So I think that's a very good question, and I think we have to be talking with our federal delegation about that very issue, because we have been prudent in Oregon, and I say fortunate. I think that the people in the 70s when this was set up in statute did a very good job. They were very smart. They looked carefully at what it would take to remain solvent, and it pretty much has remained solvent, you know, over a long period of time. It served people well, and we're usually asked a number of questions about how did we do this, and states are referred to our statutes to look at it. There was a delegation from China here 2 weeks ago visiting Oregon, and they came by the department. They were making a number of stops, and one of their questions was about this trust fund and how we paid benefits, and they were looking at this mechanism for their own country in terms of what they might be able to do. So I don't know who should get all the credit, but it has served the state very well, frankly. So I think you raised a very good question, though, about what's that going to look like at the federal level if we have $90 billion in borrowing from various states to pay unemployment insurance benefits. The folks that are solvent, what does that mean?
Now, Madam Chair, most of us know that we're a net donor state already, and we pay more in federal taxes than we get back from all federal programs. There's a number of reasons for that. And I'm not making a big fuss out of that right now, but I would sure hate to see us essentially punished because we've been prudent and careful. And I think that those states that have to borrow should have to repay that borrowed money by raising their rates and raising their threshold. and should have to repay it with some minimal interest.
Yeah. I think the federal statute allows them to set their base level of wages and set up their own structure, and it may be that at the federal level, the statutes need to get more explicit about what it requires states to do.
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, a telling piece of information I cited in a workshop there about trust fund solvency, and no state legislature has indexed their wage base like Oregon since Oklahoma did in 1986. So there was, you know, unemployment insurance doesn't get much attention in the good times, and then in the bad times, everybody goes, oh, my gosh, what were we doing? Yeah. Thankfully, in Oregon, I'm personally quite proud as a career unemployment insurance employee of what the legislature did for us in 1975 to set us up. So we're not struggling, and we are held up as a shining beacon for other states to follow.
Well, I wasn't here in 75, but I was here in 77.
Well, you're our institutional memory in that case. So, I wanted to ask, so we became eligible for these additional federal funds by virtue of adopting the alternate base year, which we did. Have those funds then flowed into our trust fund now, or are there still more that we're awaiting?
Madam Chair, the May calculation, because we had worked on this with you during the session starting early, we got the money, and that $91 million is what it was, is in this trust fund balance now. We did receive all the funds that were available for Oregon because of the legislation that was passed.
So the relative
not all states did that either.
Trust fund.
Just so you know, not all states did that either.
There are only a handful of states that qualified under all aspects of that UI modernization, and Oregon was one of them. And we had our applications in upon signature of the law.
So we're actually, to that extent, protected against even a more precipitous situation with our trust fund because we qualified for those funds. Okay. So, other questions for the director or this panel? Okay. Well,
thank you very much.
Thank you
for keeping us posted and for implementing the legislation so expeditiously. And next we have Art Ayer, who's the state labor economist from the Employment Department, who's going to talk, I think, a little more globally about what's going on with the picture of employment in Oregon. And I think we heard from you, Art, sort of at the beginning of last session, but welcome back to the Commerce and Workforce Development Committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Art Ayer, State Employment Economist with the Oregon Employment Department. And you have a handout, I believe, and I've prepared a PowerPoint that may help clarify some of the graphs because some of them have multiple lines with colors and they'll be a little bit hard to discern on the black and white handout. I'll start with the slide. Should I wait a moment?
There's a little glitch on the laptop. So,
okay.
I don't know if we want to take a minute break to get this
started. Sure. Why don't we just stand at ease for 5 minutes while we let
All right.
Committee will come back to order, and it looks like we're in business, so welcome back, Art Ayer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, again, to start, to start with, I'd like to show where Oregon stands relative to other states as of August. These are the preliminary unemployment rates. The four categories show low to high, and Oregon is in the high category of 11% unemployment rate or more. In fact, we, as Lori mentioned earlier, we tied with California for fourth highest unemployment rate in the nation. Obviously, Michigan was highest, followed by Nevada and then Rhode Island, and then Oregon and California tied for fourth. A very common question is, why is Oregon so high? Gee, if we were Michigan, it would be easy. Probably nobody would ask because it would be obvious, but it's not so obvious for Oregon. There are a variety of reasons. We are somewhat tied to California's economy, and of course that had a substantial downturn, and that affected Oregon. But also we have a concentration in durable goods manufacturing, and those have been very hard hit, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. The next slide shows our unemployment rate over time, going all the way back to 1976. And the thing that I'd like to point out here is that we are at a record high, at least since the 1976 series began, the series that began in 1976 began. We did touch 12.1% back in the early 1980s, November of 1982, but we've been bouncing around 12%, actually as high as 12.2% since March of this year. So very high level, and we went into this recession very, very quickly. You can see we don't have anything in that historical series that shows that kind of a rapid onset of high unemployment rate for such a rapid rise between 5.0% in the early part of 2007 to 12% in 2009. So,
question?
Yes,
Madam Chair.
Senator Monroe.
How is the unemployment rate calculated? Is it just those who apply for unemployment insurance, or?
Madam Chair.
Because there's been a lot of discussion that the true figure is probably much higher than that because there's people that just give up.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, excellent question. This is one that we get fairly often, and there's a lot of misconception about this, as you mentioned. The unemployment rate is calculated by a formula that is based on a monthly household survey. There are almost 1,000 households in Oregon that participate in a survey that's administered by the U.S. Census Bureau on behalf of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and that household survey asks questions about the age of the residents in the household, whether or not they're working, whether or not they're looking for work. So that is the basis for determining who is unemployed in Oregon. It has nothing to do with whether or not they are receiving unemployment insurance benefits or have applied for unemployment insurance benefits. That is not a material factor in whether they're counted as unemployed. For example, someone who has been in high school and graduates from high school and starts looking for work would be counted as unemployed, even though they have not had any employment, would not be eligible, and I'm pretty sure I can say this, would not, in most cases at least, be eligible for unemployment insurance benefits, but by virtue of the fact that they don't have a job, they are looking for work, they're available for work, they would be counted as unemployed. In August, we had about 235,000 people estimated as being unemployed in Oregon. I believe we had around 170,000 people receiving unemployment insurance benefits. So you can see that there is some daylight between the number who are actually on unemployment insurance benefits, receiving those benefits, and those who are counted as unemployed.
Mm-hmm. So, Madam Chair, follow up.
Yes, follow up.
So they would have to be actively looking for work to be counted as unemployed?
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, yes, that is correct. There is a definition of actively working that the Bureau of Labor Statistics has defined, and that includes more than just looking in the newspaper. One actually has to be applying for work or actively going out and talking with potential employers.
Okay. So people that have just given up on it may drop through the cracks and not be counted. And also, it doesn't calculate those people that are, quote, underemployed, that may have been employed full-time, and then during the recession, they're down to 25 hours a week or something like that.
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, that is correct. There are what the Bureau of Labor Statistics calls alternative measures of underemployment that they publish monthly at the national level. They have just recently started publishing those quarterly for all states. The quarterly averages are the quarterly publications actually are an annual average of the most recent four calendar quarters. So they include this graph actually helps point that out. They include that period of time when we were substantially lower than where we are now. So the four-quarter average for Oregon for some of these alternative measures that include more of the people who are not working up to their potential, that is to say they have dropped out of the labor force or they're working part-time for economic reasons, those measures do include those, but right now the four-quarter averages are lower than what they would be for the most recent month because they include prior months when our unemployment rate and our employment situation was rather different. The six measures are called U1 through U6, and the ones that are most interesting right now are U4, U5, and U6. U4, well, I'll go back to U3. U3 is the standard unemployment rate. U4 adds in what are called discouraged workers. These are people who have dropped out of the labor force specifically because they feel there is no point in trying to look for work because they're not likely to find it. We don't have an estimate of discouraged. We don't have a solid measure of discouraged workers for Oregon. We have attempted to estimate it based on national relationships, and that estimate comes in at around 13,000. So our best guess as to the number of people who are discouraged in Oregon is somewhere around 13,000. That doesn't add a whole lot to the unemployment rate if you were to tack it on and look at the U4 rate, but it does boost it a little bit. The next rate, which is U5, includes all marginally attached people. These are people who say that they would like work, but they're not currently looking for work for a variety of reasons, not just discouragement, but a variety of other reasons, and that does boost the underutilization rate somewhat more. And then U6 adds in those people who are working part-time for economic reasons. That is to say, they would like full-time work, but their schedule, or they're unable to find full-time work, and that actually boosts the rate quite substantially. In fact, at the national level, we do have information that shows, let's see, I've got this later slide, that over the last year, the nation lost about 7.4 million full-time jobs, but it gained about 2 million part-time jobs. So there was a shift. There was a reduction in average weekly hours of work. A number of people went from working full-time to part-time. And, of course, the net effect was a loss of about 5.4 million jobs. At the same time, over that same period, the increase in the number of people unemployed was about 5.4 million. So the overall labor force didn't change, but we had, on net, about 5.4 million people working or moving from working to not working status. And most of those people who were in the unemployed, that increase in the unemployed, those people were looking for full-time work. So a big shift in the character of work toward part-time work. Does that
and the point I'm trying to make is that 12.2% means one Oregonian in eight, roughly, is unemployed. But in fact, the impact of this recession is greater than that.
Yes, that is correct. Going on to the employment picture, this graph starts in 1990 and shows the growth in Oregon's non-farm payroll employment. The rapid growth during the mid-1990s with the growth of the high-tech industry, a little bit of a slowdown in the late 90s with the Asian financial crisis, the recession of the early 2000s, then the growth that started basically in the middle of 2003 and accelerated in 2004, 2005, and 2006, rather rapid growth during that period. And then the slowdown in 2007 and the recession that began really at the end of 2007 and on into 2008. From the middle of 2003 to the end of 2007, we added about 170,000 jobs from the start of 2008 to what is projected to be the bottom at the end of 2009. We are expected to have lost a total of 120,000 jobs, so not quite what we gained since the middle of 2003. The projection for the turnaround starting at the beginning of next year is that it will take about three and a half years to recover those 120,000 jobs, that we won't get back to that peak level that we experienced at the end of 2007 and the beginning of 2008 until the second quarter of 2013, almost three and a half years. From that point forward, in the middle of 2013 forward, we're expected to grow by about 1.6% per year in non-farm payroll employment, and population is expected to grow by about 1.2% per year. Just over the last year, and this isn't actually from the peak employment level prior to the onset of the recession, but just from August of 2008 to August of 2009, we've lost a little bit over 100,000 jobs, or about 5.8% of our non-farm payroll employment. And I should point out that non-farm payroll employment, of course, doesn't include farm employment, and it doesn't include self-employment. And those are two important exceptions to keep in mind as we look at these numbers, but these numbers do include the vast majority of jobs in Oregon. Manufacturing was the major source of job loss in Oregon over the last year, and that was particularly true in durable goods manufacturing, which was down about 18% over the last year, and machinery was down about 35%, primary metals 24%, and wood products 22%. So some very, very large percentage declines in employment in manufacturing over the last year. The non-durable side of manufacturing was down about 9% in our estimates over the last year, but fortunately the food products manufacturing portion of non-durables was down only about 1%, so relative stability in the food product manufacturing portion of manufacturing. Trade, transportation, and utilities was the next largest source of loss, job loss in the state over the last year, and the percentage declines were roughly equal in both the trade and the transportation services portion of trade, transportation, and utilities. The utilities portion, the private utilities portion, was essentially unchanged over the last year. The professional business services industry showed a fairly large loss over the last year, as well as a fairly large percentage decline. And I might point out that within the professional business services, this includes employment services, which is where temporary help services are located. Employment services was down by about 10,300 jobs over the last year. So a pretty large fraction of professional business services job losses over the last year were in that portion that includes temporary help jobs. And finally, leisure and hospitality. I wanted to point out that over the last year, full-service restaurants and accommodations were down fairly substantially.
And before you leave that, so educational and health services are lumped together, huh?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Because they seem like two such distinct sectors of employment.
This is considered a super sector that's put together by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The official North American Industry Classification System doesn't automatically combine these two, but Bureau of Labor Statistics does for their reporting purposes. We do have data on these two portions broken out. To be quite honest, our estimate of growth in this group over the last year may be slightly exaggerated. We're a little concerned about our educational portion of this sector, and we'll have to look at we're looking at that more closely, but our sample may not be accurately capturing, or as accurately as we'd like, capturing the trends in the educational portion. So this sector may actually be a little bit more or a little bit less optimistic or positive than we're showing at this point.
And is it fair to say, if you broke those two out, that the growth really is in health services at a higher rate than
unfortunately, no,
jobs?
At this point, the more rapid growth appears in the private educational services. But as I say, our sample, we're looking into that further at this point. The group as a whole has shown a little less positive trend, I would say, over the last few months, a little hesitation perhaps in its upward trend. But this is a sector that has been remarkably unfazed by the downturn, not only this recession but the prior recession. It has been remarkably stable, and the expectation is that it will continue to grow. In fact, I have some slides that show that.
Thank you.
But you said private educational.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Does not include the public schools, public universities, community colleges, and all of that.
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, that is correct. The public educational services are included in government. That includes public K through 12 and community colleges and the Oregon University System. Those are all included in government.
That explains it.
Thanks.
With all of that job loss, obviously, many more people are unemployed. You can see the graph showing the number of people unemployed rising dramatically from about 100,000 back in late 2007, especially the early part of 2007, to almost a quarter of a million in the beginning of this year, the early part of this year. The rise in the number of people unemployed was not due solely to job loss. It also was related partially to an increase in the size of the labor force. Now, as I mentioned earlier, over the last year, at least for the federal government and also for Oregon now, as of August, our labor force really hasn't changed. But that's because it came down from a peak that was back in April of this year, that peak was made. And the rapid increase to that peak appeared to be due perhaps to partially to postponed retirement, perhaps also to people jumping into the labor force to try to help out the family or household budget when that budget was threatened by the economic downturn. Since April of this year, we've seen a decline that could have been due partially to an increase in discouragement, but also due perhaps to people who had postponed retirement, and then as the capital market started improving after March, they may have decided, some of those people may have decided to go ahead with their retirement plans. So we don't have Oregon-specific or even good national data that helps prove that, but those seem reasonable assumptions at this point. This is a rather unusual blip. We've seen much smaller blips in prior recessions like this, but this is an exceptionally large one. As I mentioned earlier, our unemployment rate went up dramatically. I include on this slide a point that Senator Monroe made earlier. Part-time work is much more prevalent. And that point I made earlier about the increase in part-time as measured at the national level, we don't have good state-level measurements of this, but at the national level we do have pretty good information on the shift of jobs from full-time to part-time indicating, and of course, those national rates of underutilization, which show very high percentages for the U6 measure of labor underutilization. Turning to the industries, we see these are the six largest of 11 major super sectors, again those defined by the Bureau of Statistics, and trade, transportation, and utilities is the largest super sector, and I guess some good news there is that although it has declined, it has flattened out in the last few months, so there is at least the appearance that it is making a base, and the projection in the blocked symbols there is that industry, as well as many others, are expected to grow at least slowly from here on out. Government has flattened over the last year, has been very flat over the last year, but is expected to remain either flat or slightly positive in the outlook. Private educational and health services, as I mentioned, showed almost no change going into this recession and is expected to continue growing, especially in the near term, in the September 2009 projection of the Office of Economic Analysis. Professional and business services, which includes temporary help services, took a substantial downturn in this recession, as it did in the last recession, but is expected to come back quite quickly as well, an industry that is quite pro-cyclical, as is manufacturing, of course, where many of those temporary help workers work. And that industry is expected to continue to, manufacturing is expected to continue to decline through part of 2010 before it turns around and grows slowly. As it grows slowly, the durable goods portion of manufacturing is expected to grow the fastest. That is the most cyclical. It takes the sharpest downturns and the fastest growth during growth periods. And finally, leisure and hospitality has taken a downturn, especially, as I said earlier, in restaurants, full-service restaurants particularly, and also in accommodations, meaning hotels and motels, but is expected to grow as we go forward. The smaller industries, of course, include construction, which had a huge increase prior to the recession and then a huge loss. As of August, it was down about 26% from its March 2007 peak. It is expected to continue losing in the near term, but come back almost to its year 2000 level by 2015. So expectation of not a whole lot of growth on the horizon for construction. Mining and logging, a very small industry, includes logging, of course, and mining in Oregon is primarily construction-related, and that has lost a pretty large percentage. It's hard to see it on this graph because of the scale, but a pretty large percentage decline there, about 20% decline, and expected to have very little growth over the next 5 years.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Monroe.
Mining would be primarily then aggregate?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Monroe. Primarily aggregate mining in Oregon, at the national level, it is much more dominated by coal and oil and natural gas, and so there were very different trends during this recession between Oregon's mining and logging industry and the national mining and logging industry.
Well, I'm just wondering, what we passed a $300 million transportation package, mm-hmm. and as that starts to kick in, it seems like it would stimulate a greater need for aggregate and might improve that situation some.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, I would say that is true, although it should also affect construction, and the impact is probably going to be somewhat overwhelmed by the private sector's impact on these industries as well. Yeah. Turning to the regional perception or perspective, this graph shows the over-the-year percentage change in employment, non-farm payroll employment by region, six large regions within the state. Southern and Central Oregon were the first two, were two of the first regions to take substantial downturns in their employment, and they were followed by the coast and Eastern Oregon, and finally the Willamette Valley and Portland. As of the second quarter of this year, Willamette Valley and Portland actually had the largest percentage declines over the last year, with Eastern Oregon showing the least percentage decline, but of course Eastern Oregon has had negative situations for quite some time. And unemployment rates, similarly, the Southern and Central Oregon are topping the charts. And interestingly, the Portland area has now actually tied with Eastern Oregon. That's something that probably has not happened in the history. I have not looked back far enough to be sure, but it is there in the second quarter of 2009, at least based on our preliminary estimates. And just to zero in a little bit more geographically, you can see what the August preliminary seasonally adjusted unemployment rates look like by county in Oregon. Even those that have no shading that are relatively light, and that's to say relatively low in unemployment rate, are relatively high compared to what they consider to be normal and what is normal really even for the state in earlier years. So the ones that look least affected are still substantially higher in unemployment rate than they are used to. Finally, perhaps a little good news, although the number of weekly hours worked by production workers in manufacturing in Oregon went down very dramatically in this recession, they have come back a little bit, and that could be an auger of improvement in the employment situation, although another thing that I would look for is an increase in employment services employment, and we haven't seen that yet, so it would be nice to see both of these rising. At this point, we have a bit of an improvement in the weekly hours worked by production workers in manufacturing, and actually not only in manufacturing, but in other industries as well. So that is something of a good sign, but it may be a little bit too early to see that translate into job growth. And, of course, the forecast, as I mentioned earlier, is for a little bit more job loss to the end of this year. We have another few months to go, according to the September forecast from the Office of Economic Analysis, but then we should start to see some net job growth in early and mid-2010. Finally, taking a longer-term perspective, of course, the baby boomers are closing in on their late career and retirement years, and at least in the long term, that should ameliorate the employment situation. Of course, it ultimately could make it more difficult for employers to find qualified workers, but in the immediate term, the concern is workers trying to find jobs. So with that, I'd be happy to take any further questions you have.
So when you came to see us at the beginning of last session, you were reporting on a study that the department had done about just sort of projections about where the jobs of the future were going to be, which I can't remember what that was entitled, but I'm just curious whether anything that's been going on in the meantime has caused any rethinking of where people should look for training and job security.
Madam Chair, I'm struggling to remember exactly what I said back then. I think what we were probably talking about is the 2006 to 2016 projections. We are in the process of updating those to 2008 to 2018, and our projections look like they are going to come in with slower rates of growth, slower decadal rates of growth. But the general pattern, I would say, is very similar to what we saw in the last projection, with healthcare topping the the list. Obviously, there is talk about health care reform at the national level, and we don't know exactly what that might do to health care employment. But nevertheless, our current projections are looking like health care is going to be the growth industry in Oregon, and professional business services, of course, is another one in the September 2009 forecast from the Office of Economic Analysis that looks like a growth area. Obviously, manufacturing is not expected to be a substantial growth area, except durable goods manufacturing is expected to come back out of the substantial decline it had, but the over the long term, I don't believe there's any net growth when you take into account the downturn of the recession and then the recovery period. I think in general, manufacturing is expected to be a net loser of jobs. On the other hand, as the baby boomers move into their retirement years, there should be a lot of replacement openings. So for where people look for work, it is not just the industries that are going to have net job growth. It is also those that are going to have substantial retirement and job openings due to those retirements. And we do expect the production occupations to have substantial numbers of retirements. And, of course, production occupations tend to be concentrated in manufacturing. So it's a bit of a mixed picture. We do expect job opportunities in many occupational groups, including those that are concentrated in industries that are not expecting to have substantial job growth or may even have job loss, such as production or construction and extraction. But the occupational groups that are expected to have more opportunities are those in that are focused more on the professional and business services and health services and retail and the general non-manufacturing portion of the economy.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Ayer? Okay. Well, thank you for that informative presentation.
And you're very welcome.
And so, members, that brings us to the end of the employment part of our agenda. Do we don't need to take a break for any reason, unless members, do you need one? Okay. So I think we'll just keep moving through the agenda. And next, we actually are going to hear from the Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or Oregon OSHA. And this is actually an agency that we did not have time to get an overview presentation from during the regular session earlier this year. So we thought now that we've got a little more time, we would invite the administrator, Michael Wood, to come and see us and tell us what's been going on in the area of health and safety. So welcome to the Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development, and we'll give you a moment to make sure our technology is caught up with our human capacity here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for not assuming that problems with the technology actually are related to my human capacity. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you here today. For the record, my name is Michael Wood. I'm the administrator of the Occupational Safety and Health Division of the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services. Generally, I say Oregon OSHA because I can more easily get that out in one breath. I am here today to provide information, including a number of statistical pieces of information, regarding Oregon OSHA's activities. Oregon OSHA administers the Oregon Safe Employment Act, and the stated purpose of that act is to assure as far as possible safe and healthful working conditions for every working man and woman in Oregon. I start with that because I think it's important that everything we do in Oregon OSHA has to be tested against that purpose. We do a large number of things, but the reason for our existence is not to provide enforcement, to provide educational workshops, worksite consultations, publications, website information, video contests for teen videos, resources from our resource library, public education workshops, support for outreach conferences, or any of the other many things that we do. Our overriding focus is to use all of those tools and any others that we can come up with to eliminate and reduce hazards that can cause injury, illness, and death. As I'm sure you know, Oregon OSHA also is guided by the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Act. We are a state plan program, and just under half the states operate a state program in which we implement the federal provisions of the law. And actually, that's the only way that a state can run an occupational safety and health program under the terms of the federal law. So we are a designee and a grantee, but we are largely able to implement our own strategies, and there are certainly a number of areas where the way we do things may vary from the federal approach. A few weeks ago, the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services announced a proposed reduction in the pure premium rate for the workers' compensation premium of 1.3%. That expected rate decrease will mark the 20th straight year of declining or flat workers' compensation premiums. And out of those 20 years, the rate has declined all but four. One of the reasons for this impressive record is, I am convinced, the recognition that the starting point in controlling workers' compensation claims is the prevention of injury and illness in the first place. If you look at the... It took me a long time to master the mouse. Mastering a computer without the mouse is a real challenge. If you look at the first slide, this shows in recent years the injury and illness rate reported for Oregon by the National Bureau of Labor Statistics. And as you can see, it's dropped to a rate of 5.1 per 100 workers in 2007, and it has tended in recent years to show a steady decline, not dramatic in any particular year, but accumulated, that's actually a 19% decrease since the year 2000. And I've just been sitting here bouncing ahead, haven't I? Yeah. Okay. So are we all having fun? Yeah. Yeah. So, and here I was concerned how the technology would work. It is time now, Madam Chair, to recognize that the problem is not the technology. Keep my finger up until I'm ready to use it. The other thing that's worth mentioning in relation to this chart is that in 1988, the same rate was 11.1 cases per 100 work sites. Now, occasionally there's a lot of discussion about whether the Bureau of Labor Statistics injury and illness rate captures all injuries. And for a variety of reasons, it doesn't, particularly in relation to occupational disease. What I do believe it is a relatively good indicator of is progress over time, particularly within the same set. So while, you know, I'm not confident that the rate we report now is exactly the rate of injury, in fact, I'd be surprised if it's that precise, what I am confident is that the improvement that we see year by year and over the last two decades is genuine improvement. And it shows up in other indicators. It shows up in the workers' compensation system, in the claims data that's reported there. It also shows up generally in the fatality rate, which is shown, you know, it's a small number, so it bounces around, but has shown a steady decline over the same 20-year period. I would suggest it's that steady decrease that is the reason that we can say that we have managed to have a successful program. Looking at...
Before we leave that point, could you tell us what is counted then in that rate? Does it correlate with what our workers' comp system covers, or is it some other measure?
The total case incidence rate would be roughly comparable to the total claims rate in workers' compensation. We don't, in Oregon, normally track the total claims rate because the data that we have available to us at DCBS is the accepted disabling claims rate. And that's a claim that involves time loss. This does not involve time loss. This would involve any injury where there is a disability, but also in any injury where there's medical treatment in excess of first aid. So it would tend to report a higher number And that isn't an indication that there's an inconsistency between the two systems. It's that they're actually tracking different numbers. Over time, looking at the workers' compensation data and looking at the total case incidence rate as well as what's called the DART rate, which is days with restricted or off-duty disability, they tend to track over large periods. Interestingly enough, they don't always track year to year. There is some variation. The other thing to remember about the Bureau of Labor Statistics data is it's a survey. It is a statistical extract from a survey, where, of course, when we look at the claims data, we're looking at the entire population. And so we tend to look at both to ensure that they tend to confirm one another. And over time, they do, as I say, the general trend and the general downward trend certainly shows up in every system that we look at.
And I know your graph chart there stopped at 2007. Is there anything interesting that's gone on as we've gone into this massive period of unemployment that might be different from that trend?
Madam Chair, the Bureau of Labor Statistics data is the most recent data available is 2007. One of the problems with the data is it does have a fairly long lag, particularly for producing the state level data. That said, the general workers' compensation trend hasn't changed dramatically. What I would expect to see in those numbers is I would expect to see a continued decline over the couple years we've had previously for two reasons, even aside from our success. The first one is that when you look in the presentation you just got from Art Air about where the reductions in employment have been, you'll notice that a number of those are in what we would think of as high-hazard industries, construction, logging, manufacturing. So to the extent we look at a statewide average and there's been a shift in our employment base, that should take the rate down as those higher-risk activities decline. That's not the right way to push a rate down, obviously. The other thing that tends to be true is that when there's an economic contraction, although there are some things that can push injuries up, increased stress, inattention, those sorts of things, the reality is that you contract to your more experienced workers, and you don't have the pressures of growth to put people on the job who aren't yet fully trained to do it or to work excessive overtime or do a number of things. So it tends to be the case that the actual rate drops somewhat when there's an employment downturn and then spikes dramatically when there's a recovery, particularly if it's a rapid recovery, because all those things are in reverse. You're now pushing the staff you have, you're bringing staff on who aren't fully trained, and of course in our past recoveries here we've also had really dramatic growth in the construction industry, which does tend to drive the overall average rate up.
Thanks.
Turning away from that basic measure of results to take a look at some of our activity, one of our primary sets of activity, or two of our primary sets of activity, involve actual visits to work sites by our enforcement and consultation staff. And the chart in front of you shows over the last 10 years what our level of inspections and consultations have been. And you'll notice that in recent years we have seen a steady upward trend in both those cases. And in fact, consultations, we expect this calendar year to top 3,000 worksite consultations. That's a fairly dramatic increase in both those areas. And it's not, in our mind, just a measure of our activity. We genuinely believe that the presence of our staff on these worksites makes a difference in terms of the level of safety that we see on those work sites, not only from having a robust enforcement presence, but also from the educational opportunities that we find not only in our consultations, but candidly, we try to make our enforcement activity an educational opportunity for the employers and workers as well. That's one of the things that really has served us well in this state. The next two slides show you some distribution by the industrial group. And this slide shows the enforcement activity, specifically the safety enforcement activity, as it relates to the period beginning last October and running through this most recent July. Now, as you'll see, even with the economic downturn and the impact on construction enforcement activity is still a significant portion of our book of business. We do a lot of work in construction. We also have a significant presence in logging. Logging is a smaller industry, but our presence in that industry is very high relative to the size of the injury and the industry. Excuse me. And then you see the other pieces that play out there. We do, as you see, have a relatively small presence under our current scheduling system in manufacturing. And that's one of the things that contrasts with the next slide, where you'll see that in our consultation activity, and this, of course, involves employers inviting us or accepting the consultation, we have a lesser presence in construction and a much more significant presence in manufacturing. I would speculate that one of the reasons for that is that I think it relates to employer size, and one of the things we know is that the smallest employers tend not to call our consultants, even though we consider them a priority. Construction, of course, has a much larger small employer population than does manufacturing, and I think that's one of the differences you're seeing here as these two play out.
And where do healthcare institutions show up on that pie chart?
Healthcare institutions are not broken out as a separate category. I believe that they show up in two places, depending upon whether they are public or private. I think that they would show up in the government, the local government piece, if they're a public operated hospital, and then I think they show up in services. And we do have a significant presence in healthcare. Not only is it a growing industry, it's an industry that in recent years has struggled with injury and illness trends that haven't been consistent with the statewide picture. We've seen injury and illness rates actually go up in healthcare a number of the recent years. And have tried to do a number of things to address that. One of the primary drivers of that, I think probably most people are aware, are issues surrounding patient handling. And as time passes and as our population gets older, both our working population and the population that they're serving in healthcare, and as the population they're serving in healthcare gets larger, those all create issues around patient handling that mean that the questionable practices that we may have been, in a sense, able to get away with in the past, we aren't able to get away with now, and we aren't going to be able to get away with them in the future. Looking specifically at enforcement, one of the things that the national AFL-CIO does every year is they do a comprehensive report, they've done it I think for 18 years now, on the state of safety and health in the workplace. And one of the things that they track is sort of the theoretical number of years it would take to inspect every work site in the state based on the current level of productivity. Now, obviously, this is a manufactured number because it assumes that during that period you wouldn't visit any workplace twice. And in fact, in a number of cases, we'll visit the same workplace twice in a given year, and certainly over the period of 15 years, there are many workplaces we visit. And it doesn't take into account the difference between high-hazard workplaces where we really need to put our attention and relatively low-hazard workplaces where it's probably not an issue. But it does provide a useful construct for sort of the level of enforcement penetration. If you look at this number, you will see that over the years we have gone from an average of being able to inspect every workplace once every 15 years to once every 24 years. And that is largely, although not entirely, the result of the growth in the population where we, the number of employers, the number of workers, the number of work sites that we've had to potentially visit. This presents the same figure on a national picture. And I realize that the picture is not terribly great in its resolution, but if you want to find Oregon, you can swing your vision far to the right. You are more likely to experience an Oregon OSHA enforcement visit than you are likely to experience an OSHA enforcement visit in any other state in the country. 24 years may not be an impressive number in sort of the abstract, but it is the best performance in the country, and we consistently show that we have a higher enforcement presence here than in most other states. If you look to the other extreme, you'll find the state of Arkansas, which is a federal state and which has the dubious distinction of actually having an enforcement presence where it would take them more than 300 years to inspect every workplace in their jurisdiction. And there's a range of distributions on the middle. I think that where this is particularly relevant is in the discussions that sometimes come up related to penalties, because it is also true that Oregon is a low penalty state, at least for the first-time offender. And the figure that you show here tracks our average penalty year to year, and compares that to the average penalty across the country year to year. And you will notice that we generally run right around a third for the first-time serious violation, and that's the indicator that's tracked here. The distribution for states as a group runs generally between us, although this year South Carolina actually has a lower average penalty than we do. But they run between that 350 mark up to about 1,150 or 1,200, and it pulls the average up. The only state that has a penalty, an average first-time serious penalty significantly higher than that is California, where it approaches 4,000 because of some different statutory penalty requirements that are built into their program. One of the things that I remind people when they look at these low first-time penalties is, first of all, that doesn't take into account the fact that we steepen the level considerably for repeat offenders. It doesn't take into account the fact that we actually require employers to fix violations while they appeal them, rather than letting them file an appeal and hold off on fixing the violations. We're the only state in the country that has that provision in the statute. And then the other piece is that you really have to look at the level of penalties in relation to the overall enforcement presence. It's true that the penalty in Oregon is likely to be lower than it would be in other states, at least across the board as an average. It's also true that you're much more likely to be inspected in Oregon than you are in other states, and I tend to view those two as a balancing factor. Putting on a pure enforcement official cap for a moment, I would certainly rather have a high presence in the workplace rather than rare but high penalties. It's probably not that important how high the penalties are going to be in the state of Arkansas, given how unlikely the inspection itself is.
So does that reflect sort of a difference in the level at which our penalty amounts start compared to a similar violation in other states then?
Madam Chair, it reflects a difference in the penalty matrix that we've adopted as an agency. It does not reflect a difference in the statutory framework. With the exception of California, I believe all 49 states operate with a $7,000 maximum penalty for a serious or other than serious violation and a $70,000 penalty for a willful or repeat violation. The question is how you use the issues under those maximums. And we have long been a program that had applied a penalty chapter that established a relatively low average. And then, as I say, actually we're fairly steep in applying the repeats compared to a number of other jurisdictions. I've actually begun conversations with the partnership group that advises me and with some other groups to look at whether there's a way that we can use our existing penalty authority more effectively to really get the behavior we want. That's not so much focused on increasing the average as in making sure that we're issuing the penalties for the right things and at the right times and in the right way, that we're taking into account the size of the employer, for example, to an appropriate level. Currently, that's a relatively modest change in our penalty chapter. And so those are the sorts of issues that we want to look at to make sure that we really are making effective use of the penalty authority that the Legislative Assembly has granted us.
And do the penalty amounts automatically adjust for inflation, or are these amounts that are absolute?
Madam Chair, they do not. Neither the statutory maximums nor our penalty chapter as adopted adjusts for inflation. Now, obviously, one thing we could do in the rulemaking context is make that adjustment as long as we stay below the maximum penalty adjustments. There is a proposal before Congress called the Protecting America's Workers Act that has a number of provisions in it. One of them would be to increase the maximum penalties and then to index it for inflation in order to create that sort of automatic ongoing adjustment.
So right now, are you saying you have rulemaking authority to make those adjustments, but there are statutory maximums that would have to be changed by the legislature?
Madam Chair, that's correct. We have rulemaking authority to make the adjustments, and frankly, in most cases, we are well below the statutory maximums, so it wouldn't really be necessary to adjust those. Currently, the maximum penalty under the rules that my staff will issue without invoking my discretion for a violation that could result in a fatality and that we see a relatively high probability of occurring, we've set that maximum in rule at $5,000. The statutory maximum would allow us to go up to $7,000, and that's a change that we could make through the rulemaking process if we chose.
Thanks.
The next slides just show some data about some of our other programs. Here you can see a summary of various of what we roll together under what we call public education. These are programs that we put on to educate employers and workers, often targeted at supervisors and members of safety committees, on a variety of topics. And as you can see, we lay them out in a variety of venues. We also, as you'll see at the bottom, specifically track some of our training efforts related to limited English proficiency. And much of what we do there is in the context of training the trainers so that they can transfer that knowledge on and equipping them to deal with a population that has limited English skills. The outreach conferences are one of the unique things about the Oregon program. Most state programs support some conferences. We work with a number of different partners to put on a number of conferences around the state. If you notice the attendance figures there, you will see that we have had a drop-off in attendance. I wouldn't suggest that that's a result of the quality of the conferences or the work that goes into it. I think that's a matter of people looking closely at their budget. What you may also notice is that the regional conferences, which are sometimes shorter and obviously our local events, have actually experienced less of a drop-off than the large Governor's Occupational Safety and Health Conference that we put on last spring did. And that's probably good. It would be nice to see all of these sustained, but the truth is that the GOSH conference tends to be a conference for safety professionals and safety practitioners. The other conferences tend to be conferences that are somewhat more effective in reaching folks who are doing the day-to-day work, partly simply a matter of proximity. And then finally in the slides, I've put together the two recognition programs that we operate. We, like other states, operate the Voluntary Protection Program, and that is a recognition program that sets a high bar for achievement. Those sites are specifically approved by me following extended site visits by my staff. The threshold to get into the Safety and Health Achievement Recognition Program is somewhat lower. It's designed, in a sense, as a second-tier program for people, work sites that perhaps are on their way but may not have fully arrived, and it's designed to maintain a continuing relationship with those programs. If you look at the numbers in that pie chart, it is a relatively small set of programs across the state. It represents 235 work sites in total. But it does mean that these are people who have taken advantage of the opportunity to really achieve a level of safety and health in the worksite that is far above the common norm in their industry, and that's the purpose of these recognition programs. Having been through all these charts, I guess the one thing that I would close with is just to remind you that really, from our perspective, the most important chart is the one I started with, and that is that we continue to see a decrease in the injury risks. And in the resulting injury rate. It's harder to track occupational disease, but we work to push those rates and risks down as well. And we work to push fatality risks down. Those are the issues that we focus on, and everything else we do is designed to support and reinforce that goal. I would be happy to answer any further questions you might have.
So one of the things, Michael, that you didn't talk a lot about, I think you just kind of passed over it a little bit, was safety committees. And I think one of the things that Oregon is known for is having these requirements for management labor safety committees. Can you talk a little bit about what that applies to and how those work in the scheme of your enforcement and consultation?
Madam Chair, I would be happy to. As you indicate, one of the somewhat unique features, although there are other states that have variations on it, but certainly one of the important features of the Oregon Safe Employment Act has been the reinforcement of worker-employer collaboration in promoting safety and health in the workplace through the safety committee structure. Under the current rules and the current statute, which was amended in the 2007 legislative session, all employers now must have at least safety meetings in their workplaces. Small employers can use safety meetings rather than having a representative committee. Large employers who aren't in the mobile industries still need to have a safety committee structure. But under the rules, and actually the last provision of that just took effect, under those rules, the expectation now is that there'll be some level of ongoing employer and employee collaboration specific to safety and health issues in the workplace in every work site in the state of Oregon. We actually in the Oregon OSHA resource, our electronic newsletter that goes to, well, I guess it doesn't go to print, goes to net or whatever you'd want to call it, in a couple days, we've highlighted a number of employers who over the years have had real success in building exemplary safety and health programs based on the way they've used their safety committees and the way they've used the safety meeting structure. It is clear that the way to achieve the highest results of safety and health in the workplace is through that sort of collaborative work and through genuine employee involvement. And employers who stop short of that end up stopping short in what they achieve as well. Certainly, every voluntary protection program site that we recognize has a model of an effective safety and health committee, because that's the only way, you know, not only is it something we look at, it's also the only way that they can achieve the overall conditions in the workplace that we'll demand before we'd approve them as a VPP site.
Okay, any other questions? Yes, Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Michael, you began the session by saying that Oregon joins half the states in taking responsibility for the safety and welfare of their employees. What do the other half of the states do?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, in the other half of the states, federal OSHA enforces directly. If you look at the chart that showed the distribution of enforcement activity by state, one of the other realities of that chart is the state programs, by and large, have a higher enforcement presence. The programs that are at the left side of that chart tend to be federal programs. The programs on the right-hand side of that chart, like Oregon, tend to be state programs. They simply aren't staffed at the level that we are and that most other states that have made a commitment to the safety and health program are. One of the other realities is that public employees in those states are not protected under the Occupational Safety and Health Act. It's a unique feature of the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Act that it requires a state program, if we have one, to apply to local and state government employees, but the federal law does not itself apply to local and state government employees. So in the state of Idaho, there is no OSHA structure in place with regard to the state and local employees within the state, and that's true in about half the country.
Follow-up.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Would you say that most of this then is a financial that drives the choice, whether they have their state program or just utilize the federal program, is more financially driven?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, I think that it has more to do with the history of the states and what they had in place in the early 70s. Those states that had developed a program out of their workers' compensation activity tended to carry that forward. So a state like Oregon, where we had the Accident Prevention Division of the Workers' Compensation Board, carried that forward. That's true in many other states. The other thing that tends to be generally true is the states that have state plans frequently are states with a deep populist tradition, and I think that there's probably just a sense there that there's a real value toward having it as local as possible. So when you look at the distribution of state programs, you find that the Midwest and the West Coast tend to be highly represented by state programs. The Old South also has a number of state programs, and really the distinction on the eastern side of the country is primarily that those states that didn't have strong union movements tended to adopt a state program, and those states in the Northeast that had strong union movements looked to the federal government as the solution to the issues. That's probably a long way of saying that it varies a lot from state to state, but it has, I think, more to do with historical factors than it does to do with the specific budgetary constructs.
Would you say there's any correlation then? You talk about the enforcement is different because there's obviously with the federal there's less enforcement. Would you say our in Oregon workers are healthier and have safer work environment than those states that are using the federal?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, yes, I would say that. Your follow-up question at that point would be, how would I demonstrate it? And one of the realities of the Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers is that they don't appear to provide good state-to-state comparisons. I used them earlier as sort of a comparison of our history. It is true that if you look at fatality numbers over time, that there does appear to be a correlation between those states that have relatively low fatality rates and those states that have state plans. And I think that has a lot more to do with the overall program than it does with enforcement alone. It's true that you're more likely to be subject to an enforcement visit in the state of Oregon. You're more likely to have a consultation and have a consultant available in the state of Oregon as well. The educational efforts that we put into our publications and to our workshops also are part of the unique program. Just the entire fabric of workplace safety and health, I think, is more robust, not only from the government perspective, but particularly in this state, from a recognition by employers and workers that there is a direct tie into what your workers' compensation costs.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
If workers are safer in this state, that should have an impact on workers' compensation rates, does it?
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, I believe that the reason that we have, not the exclusive reason, but a significant reason that we have seen workers' compensation premium rates decreased over the last 20 years is because of the fact that employers, workers, and Oregon OSHA have collaborated together to make the workplaces safer. And yes, I do believe that that has shown up in reduced workers' compensation rates.
And in fact, are our rates then lower than some of those states that don't have a state program?
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, that isn't actually a comparison that I have made. As you know, the Department of Consumer and Business Services does a report that looks at relative workers' compensation premiums. I've never lined up the ranking of states in that report against those states that that have state programs or that don't, and that would be an interesting exercise.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
You know, we're interested in bang for your buck. Your program costs money, state dollars, and you know, go into to support your program. Proving its cost effectiveness in terms of the financial benefit to businesses that pay workers' comp rates would be, I think, a useful kind of thing for you to work on when you're making your presentations to the legislature that funds you. It would be good for you to be able to show that you're actually saving our businesses a great deal of money in workers' comp rates by your activities.
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, I would love to be able to show it on a direct relationship. That is difficult because there are many factors that push the rates down, and it's hard to tease out exactly what is a result of our activity. What I would note is that the amount of money that is spent out of the premium assessment operating account to fund Oregon OSHA, compared to the amount that is saved by even a small downtick in the workers' compensation costs, there is no comparison. It takes a relatively small shift in the injury and illness rate to completely cover the state portion of my budget, and I'd be happy to share those numbers with you if you'd like.
Well, that's you're making my point, and again, that point needs to be made clearly. I'm not sure, you know, there's OSHA's not always been all that popular with you know, some legislators and with some businesses and so on, and you need to be able to constantly make the point that, you know, you're not only saving lives, saving injuries, but you're saving dollars.
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, I certainly have occasion to encounter people who are not as happy with the work we do as I am. You're exactly right.
Thank you, Senator Monroe. And just maybe one other aspect of the program that you didn't mention today, but that I was personally involved in from its inception, is the grant program, which comes from the penalty amounts and has been really, I think, a great example of labor management cooperation through the years. So did you maybe the members aren't as familiar as I am with how that works. But.
Madam Chair, we have two programs in essence. We do have the grant program where we provide training grants to organizations that work to develop new training materials or new methods of training delivery. We have explored some different train-the-trainer models and some things particularly in relation to construction with some of the recent grants that we've issued. And that has, there are materials in our resource center. There are materials used by people not only in the state but frankly all over the country that are the result of Oregon OSHA having issued a grant, and those cover a wide range of topics over the number of years, as obviously, Madam Chair, you know, as a past member of the committee that handled that. In addition, we do have the Worker Memorial Scholarships, which are also handled through the same committee and in much the same fashion. And I will say that one of my great pleasures every year is the ability to award those scholarships. I know that the tragedies are there. I know that there are individuals who have lost their parent or sometimes a spouse to workplace injury or to permanent disability, to death. It's good that we have a program that allows us to help offset at least some of the financial and job security loss that is created there. And what has struck me over the years as I've looked at those scholarship winners is that they are largely going into some version of what you might call a service profession. Consistently, their career goals talk about the importance of serving others, and it seems to be a continuing message that we get as we listen to where they plan to go with their futures.
Great. Yes, Senator Monroe.
One more. One of my passions is traffic safety, and I believe it's still true that the number one cause of death or injury in the workplace is automobile accidents. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, yes, that is correct.
So anything we can do to make our roads and highways safer and encourage people to use proper restraints and so on helps you with that job.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Senator Monroe. And thank you very much for your presentation, and hopefully we'll be able to see you again in the future.
Thank you.
Okay, and so...
The lights went on. Wake up.
So last on our agenda is an update on what's going on with the Management Labor Advisory Committee, and since there was a lot of talk about workers' comp in the health and safety arena, we'll close with this presentation, which will dovetail nicely. So it looks like we have Lou Savage and Sherry Sundstrom and some other people with you today. Thanks. Welcome to the Senate Interim Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lou Savage. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. One of the things I do is I'm the Administrator for the Management Labor Advisory Committee. But as these talented folks next to me will demonstrate, they need very little administering. I'm kind of the air traffic controller for some of the issues, and really that's probably the best description of what I do. They really should have been on the agenda because they're the stars of what we do at MLAC. But as Teresa knows, we were trying to figure out who would be available for which committees. So we really appreciate them being here. To my immediate right is Jerry Ray. To her right is Tracy Brill. And to her right is Sherry Sundstrom. As I think you probably know, the Management Labor Advisory Committee was created as a part of the workers' comp reforms in the 90s. There are five representatives, each from business and labor. They are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. You will actually be confirming MLAC members this week as part of your confirmation process. There will be a new member that will appear in front of Senate Rules this week. Her name is Pam Rona, and she, as you pointed out, Senator Rosenbaum, healthcare is a big sector in Oregon's economy. She works with the Oregon Healthcare Association. What we have tried to do, both on the labor side and the management side, is to get folks who represent various sectors of Oregon's economy. And the other thing that we are try to be very diligent about is the folks that represent management are actually folks who come from employers and not folks who are maybe stakeholders in the system, but are actually folks who represent employers. Either employers themselves are, come from employers, or represent associations who themselves represent employers. So insurers, doctors, attorneys, although they are stakeholders in the system, they are not the primary beneficiaries of the workers' comp systems, And so we really do try to make sure that folks who are on MLAC represent both management and labor. The activities of MLAG really fall into two categories. One is to review and recommend legislation to the legislature and the governor on issues that impact the workers' comp system. And the second is to work on interim projects that either the legislature, the governor, or MLAC identifies as emerging issues or even problems that have occurred in the workers' comp system, and either work with the workers' comp division to help develop rules to address those issues, or sometimes to recommend legislation to address those issues themselves. So I'm going to turn it over now to Sherry and Jerry and Tracy to talk about the specific issues that we've been working on.
Great. Thanks, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Sherry Sundstrom, and my employer is Hoffman Construction. I manage their insurance programs nationwide. We spoke to you this spring and kind of gave you an idea of what we were planning on working on, and fortunately we have a couple of highlights that we can that you all approved, and that was the work benefit bill, Senate Bill 110, and this is the death benefit enhancement that we did to the workers' compensation system. And I personally am very proud of this because I'm touched by, unfortunately, tragedy in the workplace from time to time. And this bill, it enhanced the death benefits for surviving family members. We increased the scope of the burial benefit, doubling it to 20 times the state average weekly wage, which, as I recall, it's about $15,000, a little bit over it, and that will increase annually as the average weekly wage increases. We also provided a new benefit for college-aged children of survivors who have lost both of their parents. And we take great pride in that as well, because I think they were the ones that were kind of lost in the shuffle. And we also made sure that if there is no beneficiary, that the permanent partial disability award that would have been due to the worker does go to their estate. We also, another part of that, and actually, as you all know, there was a fatality this weekend in the construction sector. And I had the opportunity to speak to the ombudsman before we walked over here. And one of the things that we wanted to make sure is there was better communication once there is a fatality between all the parties, so that the family isn't sitting out there wondering, mercy me, what do I do with, how do I go on? What are all the steps I need to take? Our ombudsman for the Workers' Comp Division, Jennifer Flood, does a phenomenal job now, and she always has, but she took this on with a passion of her own to make sure she is communicating with those families. And the funeral homes are communicating directly with her when there is a fatality. And she had already received a message this morning, yesterday afternoon, from the funeral home that was going to be handling the fatality from the weekend. So that means that what we wanted to do is working, and again, I take deep pride in that, in making sure that we are taking care of those families. Another highlight of our session that affects directly Tracy's group is the cancer presumption for firefighter bill, House Bill 2420, which added 12 types of cancers to the list of diseases presumed to be work-related among full-time firefighters. So in the interim, we are working on rulemaking for the mini bills that were passed for this last session. We also have some interim subcommittees, and I'm going to speak to you about the two that I'm directly involved in. The first is the interpreters subcommittee. This came about as a result of, partly prompted by, a bill that was sponsored by Representative Barker, and that is are injured workers being served well by interpreters when they do have a work-related injury? So we're looking at how that process works throughout the workers' compensation system, whether it be medical, when they're first injured, through the whole process, so they understand their benefits and everything. So Lon Holston, who is a labor member, is heading up that subcommittee, and he's doing a very fine job of that. And then the one that I am co-chairing with my fellow labor member, Michael Rourke, is on the notice of claims subcommittee, and this is on the amount of time you have within which to file a claim for a work-related injury and or a occupational disease claim. One of the things that we like to do is look at case law and how the law is being interpreted from the original intent of what we do as a subcommittee. We think that's very important, because not always what we intend is what other people actually realize. And so we want to make sure that we are looking at cases. And so there were some cases that came about relating to notice of claim and occupational disease exposures that we decide we need to take a little bit more of a closer look. So we're in the process of information gathering on both of these subcommittees. And then Jerry is going to speak to the third subcommittee that we're talking about.
In recent sessions, there's been some interest about volunteers and how they are or are not covered by workers' compensation. So MLAC has taken that up in the interim. We're looking at whether volunteers should be covered or not by workers' compensation. And we're taking testimony right now. And we've also gotten information from the department, and we'll be moving forward soon and decide whether there should be some action regarding the volunteers or not.
And last, although Michael would mention this, we thought we would hit again the issue of the rates, the workers' comp rates, which have decreased. We put out a press release a week or so ago about this, but we're not sure that everyone
saw it. So Tracy just wanted to hit on that briefly as well.
Good morning. I'm Tracy Brill, and I represent labor. Represent labor, and I'm with Portland Firefighters Association. And as Lou mentioned, and as Michael Wood spoke already, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'd like to just speak briefly on the decrease in premium rates for workers' comp. The question that Senator Telfer proposed was a correlation between the state OSHA and healthier workers. And while I can't answer the question on a federal basis, what I can say is that we do have a state OSHA and that we do have healthier workers, and it has created a consistent four-year decrease in rates for workers' compensation since 1990 when Mahoney Hall was put in place, which created our committee. We've had no increase in workers' compensation. The only changes that we have seen in the workers' compensation rate have been decreases. And I'm proud to say for the last 4 years that I've been on this committee, that has been a decrease, or that has consistently been just a decrease. Role of our committee is to do a detailed analysis of legislative proposals, whether they come from our committee or from outside sources. And I believe that the consistency of our approach has, as well as the safety of, provided by OSHA, has also created a situation where that decline has been in place. I would like to say that working with management group and labor group without having to take considerations of other stakeholders at the committee level has been very effective and has been able allowed us to have a good communication and to see what the needs are, as a labor person, to see what the needs are of the employers also. That's all I'd like to say about that. Thank you.
Okay. Questions for this panel? So I actually did have something that came to my attention. I did have a conversation with John Schultz briefly about it, and that is I've been contacted by some people in my district about what I think has been a problem in the past, and I don't know how it's fallen between the Medical Advisory Committee and MLAC, but it's the issue of the availability of doctors or other medical providers, but specifically MDs, to treat injured workers. And the way it was framed to me is that it continues to be a problem, that because of the additional burden on docs when they get an injured worker of paperwork or dealing with a sometimes litigious system, that not just for people when they initially have an injury, but for people maybe who have continuing medical needs after their claim has been closed, they often are still having problems finding a doctor willing to see them. So I wonder if that's something that MLAC has either worked on in the past or something that might come up in your work this interim.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is an issue that concerns the department and the Management Labor Advisory Committee. It's a big concern of ours. On the department level, I would suspect that if John Schultz was here, he would tell you that one of the goals is to reduce paperwork as much as possible so that doctors who have agreed to assist workers who have injuries have as little paperwork as possible. One of the benefits of moving to an electronic system, we hope, is that some of that paperwork can at least be done electronically and communicate directly with both the insurer and the department so that it cuts down on the time that a physician spends on the paperwork as opposed to treating the worker. And certainly, John could probably get into those details much more if you wanted to do a follow-up hearing. But if Tracy or anybody else in the committee wanted to chime in.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you know, Hoffman Construction has construction work all over the state at various times.
I personally, maybe looking through rosy-colored glasses, I've not had that problem. I have heard it from, you know, multiple sources. We have not had a problem finding doctors that will treat our workers. And one of the things that we're doing on our construction sites now is we are taking advantage of being able to do contractor-controlled insurance programs. So when I say Hoffman, I'm not looking at just Hoffman employees. I'm looking at all the subcontractors on our job site that we're now managing their work-related injuries. And part of that is the task of going in and making sure that when we do go into new communities that there are providers that are available. I think there is that stigma that's related to the paperwork. I just had a conversation with McKinsey Willamette yesterday about paperwork and making sure we're getting the information timely so that we can timely manage the claims and make sure that we're getting the bills paid timely. And I'm glad that the department is looking at that. Something else that we're looking at within MLAC is we met a couple of weeks ago with MAC, the Medical Advisory Committee, and we're committed to making sure that we are working as a unit when there are decisions or questions or concerns relating to the medical component of what we do. We want to make sure that they have input and that that they are a resource to MLAC so that we aren't out here, you know, willy-nilly looking at medical issues without the opportunity of utilizing a advisory committee that is available to us. So,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like also just to address a couple of legislative sessions ago, one of the things that we were
and
able
to... Tracy, could you just re-identify yourself?
I apologize,
so we'll have your name in our record.
For the record. Two sessions ago, we developed an expanded treatment authority for a variety of naturopathic, podiatrists, and non-traditional medical providers, including physician assistants. And part of the purpose of that was so that we could expand workers' compensation treatment availability throughout the state of Oregon.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Ray, and I benefits manager for Timber Products Company. I do need to acknowledge that, yes, I think depending on some regions of the state, I think getting treatment can be more of a challenge. We have worked with the department, and we continue to work with those providers to try to make it more user-friendly, but I think the challenge is still there and needs work.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, well, we'll look forward to having you back as we get closer to legislative concepts for the next session. Okay, thank you very much,
thank
all
you.
Of you, for being here, and thank you especially to the MLEC members for your, I know, very time-consuming and sometimes arduous volunteer work on that committee. Well, that completes our agenda for today. Members, we do have the ability to introduce committee bills for February. At the moment, if you or the other members who aren't here today have anything that you're interested in pursuing, please do bring that either to Teresa's or my attention. We've had some preliminary discussions with the Employment Department about that bill dealing with state extensions and how they dovetail with the federal extension, so that might be one place we could look given our high rate of continued unemployed people. And if there's anything else that you would like us to consider, we're certainly open to that too. I think we'll our next meeting is in mid-November.
Yes, Madam Chair, the 19th.
Right.
So after
the deadline is the 13th, yes.
Right, so if you do have things that might be legislative concepts, be sure to contact one of us before that, because we would have to put in a request with Legislative Council before our next meeting takes place. Okay, well, thank you very much. I think it's been an informative morning, and thank you to our new staff, Cindy and Teresa especially, for putting together our agenda today. And with nothing further to come before us, members, we are adjourned.